I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, the Trump administration was poised to launch military attacks against Iran for the downing of an American drone before President Trump called it off, imposing more sanctions, this time aimed at the leadership. In the last few days, the presidents of both countries have traded insults, Rouhani claiming Trump has a mental disorder and said sanctions against Iran's supreme leader were outrageous and idiotic. Trump called Rouhani's comments ignorant and threatened to bring overwhelming force against Iran, including obliterating assets if Iran attacks anything American. Now, the U.S. pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal last year. The administration has a list of preconditions for talks to begin. Iran says those preconditions, including sanctions, are a non-starter. We asked Anne Guerin to join us. She is White House reporter for The Washington Post, covering foreign policy and national security. Anne Guerin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure, Marty.
You know, one of the unanswered questions, or the question that has two answers, is where was this drone that Iran shot down? Iran says it was over Iranian waters. America says it was over international waters. What do we know, or do we know?
We don't 100% for certain know, but we do know that some other countries in addition to the United States say that it was clearly in international waters. So they're backing up the U.S. version of this. But the central problem here is that Iran claims greater hegemony and control over the Straits of Hormuz, entrance to the Persian Gulf, than the United States or other countries are willing to recognize. So there's a gray area.
Well, and this also comes on the heels of an attack on some oil tankers. Now, the U.S. blamed Iran. There's some kind of questions about exactly what happened there. But is that sort of part of what we're talking about here?
Yes, the strike on an American drone was the largest and most significant in a string of incidents that goes back about 3 weeks, including the attacks a week before on two ships that were passing through the strait and had really nothing to do specifically with the United States. They were not U.S. ships. The cargo wasn't bound for the United States. There's no U.S. ownership. But they were owned or operated or destined for U.S. allies or partners. And they were operating in a shipping lane where, you know, the U.S. has always claimed that it has some control because of the importance of the Persian Gulf. And so it was an indirect, if Iran was behind it, as the United States claims, it was a sort of indirect lashing out at the world at large and the United States by extension.
The president talked about having hawks and doves in his administration. I think we can fairly say that Bolton and Pompeo are the hawks. Who were the doves in the Trump administration?
Question I've had as well. Trump has said a couple of times in the last couple of days, well, I've got people on both. I'm like, really? Like, who exactly is it other than you, the president, who is arguing that they shouldn't go hell for leather against Iran? Certainly, that had been true in the first year of the administration. Trump was surrounded by a number of foreign policy professionals, including his second national security advisor, H.R. Haldeman, and his then defense secretary, Jim Mattis, who did argue for restraint, and his first secretary of state, Rex Tillerson. Those people are all gone, mm-hmm. As are most of the close aides who worked for them. So it's not entirely clear where the notes of caution are coming from. I will amend that in one way, which is that the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's been chairman all along, General Joe Dunford, is not a complete skeptic of the administration's approach to Iran, but he is a voice of professional military caution, which is something that you know Mattis also used to provide, and that kind of tells Trump, look, you know, here are things that the military can do, here are things that it can't do, here are the possible ramifications of these various options. Here are the ways that this could play out. And those are, that's a traditional military function. You present a set of options and try to explain to the political leadership what happens if you choose A, B, or C. And Dunford is doing that. Our reporting shows that Dunford was on board with presenting the options that were presented to the president last week to have a retaliatory strike for the drone strike. So it was the president's decision, not Dunford's, to call that back.
No, the president said that he decided to abort the military strikes because he was concerned about casualties, up to 150 casualties. But it seems kind of odd for any president to know about a casualty count related to an airstrike at the very last minute.
Yeah, the potential casualty count would have been part of the information available at the first time these options were presented to the president. The timeline is a little fuzzy. The president himself has suggested a couple of different kinds of timelines for what happened on Thursday. But at some point earlier in the day, he was presented with a set of options. Now, we don't know exactly how those conversations went. We don't know for sure that he asked, if we strike this particular site, how many casualties will that cause? He described on Saturday a conversation that he had with military advisors closer to the time of launch, when he did ask very specifically, according to him, if we hit this, how many? And he says he was told that it could be 40 to 50 people per site. That matches the reporting we had independently, that they were talking about three sites. And so what the military told him, putting this together, what the military told him is, look, there could be up to 50 Iranian staff, presumably military, but whoever they were, at these three sites. Were you to hit all three? Were the maximum number of staff to be there, and were they all to die, you get up pretty close to 150. It's the outside range of what he would have been presented, but it was apparently very persuasive to him.
We are now in this sort of weird situation of this war of words. It reminds me a bit of the war of words that the president had with the head of North Korea. How do you dissect or even translate what is being said back and forth? Should we be worried about it? Or are we looking at presidents who are essentially sort of letting off steam?
I think there's definitely an element of letting off steam and an element in both cases for Trump and for Rouhani of their own domestic politics playing a role. You're right that there are parallels mm-hmm. with the situation in North Korea. I would say there's one huge difference, though, which is that Trump's calculation with Kim was right in that he thought, hey, here's a guy who probably really does want to make a deal, but needs to be able to get to a place where that's possible. And he's the control. He runs the country. I mean, he is an absolute ruler. If he says we go. If he says we stop. That factor is not present in Iran. Rouhani cannot, on his own, and he is Trump's titular counterpart, he cannot say we are breaking the 2015 deal, we are going to make a new deal with Donald Trump. That decision would have to come from within the disparate power centers in Iran, which have always been opaque to American leaders, maybe now more than ever, but ultimately resides with Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader. And that is why it is very interesting that the day two days after Trump had said they weren't going to go forward, you had a set of economic sanctions directly targeting the supreme leader and his office.
And I'll be talking about that with a couple of guests that will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. The policy the Trump administration uses, they call it the policy of maximum pressure. Translate, tell us, I mean, is that what we're seeing as we're watching what's happening with Iran in the Middle East?
I just think they needed a name for it.
What is it?
That's a good question. It is a version of the policy that different administrations have applied to Iran going back 20 years, really, which is economic sanctions in response to allegations that Iran sponsors terrorism around the world, political penalties that go with that, an attempt to persuade the Iranian leadership that they have more to gain from giving up nuclear weapons than from pursuing them. That is a bargain that the world thought it was on the way to winning with the 2015 deal. And essentially waiting for a change of political will, if not of political leadership, inside Iran. What the Trump administration is doing at its most fundamental level is not different than what previous presidents have done. They've all refrained from direct military engagement because the U.S. does not want a war with Iran. Iran doesn't want a war with the U.S. that it would probably lose. So there's an element of brinksmanship here that we haven't seen before. There's certainly a level of insult that's new in the last couple of years. But at its heart, the maximum pressure campaign, as the Trump administration calls it, is you know, their brand of U.S. policy against with Iran, with and against Iran.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, but I think it needs to be said, by all accounts, Iran was actually abiding by the 2015 deal between the United States and its allies.
Yes, and that wasn't really the complaint that the Trump administration raised with it. They didn't like that fact. It was a complicating fact for them, but their complaint is the deal didn't go far enough, and the deal was a poor one, in Trump's view, for the United States. The European partners and Russia and China that made the deal alongside the United States have pointed to Iranian compliance all along and said, look, we're not going to break a deal that Iran is complying with. And part of the U.S. pressure campaign now, according to Trump's critics, is an attempt to get Iran itself to break the deal, which would then cause the other partners to kind of have to break it or walk away too.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Ann Gearin, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And she's White House reporter for The Washington Post, covering foreign policy and national security. And after this very short break, we'll be talking more about the United States and Iran and where things stand, where we go from here. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Much to discuss. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump imposed new sanctions this week on Iran's supreme leader and threatened Iranian Republic by saying an attack on anything American will be met with obliteration. Trump also told reporters over the weekend Iran wants to become a wealthy nation again. Let's make Iran great again. Iran has called the new sanctions idiotic, indicating the path to diplomacy is closed, with President Rouhani claiming President Trump has a, quote, mental disorder. The rising hostility between the two countries follows most recently an attack on a U.S. drone and Trump's decision to call off a retaliatory military strike at the last minute. The U.S. pulled out of the 2015 Iranian nuclear deal last year. We're going to continue our conversation looking at U.S.-Iranian relations, whether negotiations are still possible, also the state of Iran's nuclear capabilities, how sanctions are affecting Iranians, and what a war would mean between the U.S., Iran, and the region. And joining us is Elizabeth Rosenberg. She's Senior Fellow, Director of the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Elizabeth Rosenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. do we have her? We will get her squared away. Also joining us, Trita Parsi, founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council. Also an adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University Center for Security Studies, author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Joining us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. Trita Parsi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And I hopefully we'll get Elizabeth Rosenberg hooked up and we will carry on our conversation. I will begin with you. It seems as if an attack was averted. Are we still at the risk of war with Iran?
We certainly are. It was a very close call last Thursday. Trump stated that what caused him to change his mind was him feeling that it was disproportionate to kill 150 Iranians in response to a drone being shot down. I think it is safe to say that the issue and his decision there was a little bit more complicated than that. I think both he as well as previous presidents have been close at various points in making a decision of striking Iran, mm-hmm. but have chosen not to for a very simple reason. Once the strike has been launched, the United States is no longer in control over what happens afterwards. The United States will not have escalation control. And this can very quickly lead to a much, much larger war that would be as devastating, if not far more so, than the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War have been. And I think that deterred Trump from doing something that, in my view, would have been extremely foolish. But he's not walked away from the brink of war, because as long as the United States is pursuing this strategy of maximal pressure, which Trump himself has called economic warfare, then the United States will continue to be on the brink of military warfare.
Let me get Elizabeth Rosenberg in on the conversation. Elizabeth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I was talking with Trita Parsi about sort of where we stand and whether there's still the risk of war with Iran between the United States and Iran. Is there a potential for just a mistake or a misunderstanding?
I think there's a very great potential for that kind of mistake or misunderstanding, which could be significantly escalatory and draw both parties, the United States and Iran, into a real hot conflict and all-out war, not just a tit-for-tat, even in the military domain where they're using those capabilities. This is a very real concern.
Well, going back to you, Trita Parsi, is there someone who wants war with Iran?
Certainly. And I think while I agree with the question that there is a risk for an accidental war, I have to be frank and say that I think the biggest risk right now is not an accidental war, but a very deliberate one. John Bolton has been on record favoring war and military strikes against Iran for more than two decades. He wrote an op-ed in February 2015, right before the nuclear deal was struck, in which he argued in favor of the title of the op-ed was Bomb Iran. Yeah. You have countries in the region, such as Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, who, at least in the past, have very strongly lobbied the United States to go to war with Iran because of their own security concerns and issues. There are some signals to the contrary now. They seem to have gotten perhaps a bit of a cold feet. But you have an explosive situation precisely because there's a lot of individuals that actually would like to see a confrontation that is in the military realm.
Elizabeth, let me read something that National Security Advisor John Bolton said just this past September, warning Iranians or the Iranian regime, if you cross us, our allies or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat and deceive, yes, there will be hell to pay. We will come after you. Do you see John Bolton itching for a fight?
Well, that's certainly one way to read that. That makes good sense to understand that as the naked threat that it is. And he's not the only one from the U.S. administration that has issued threats. We've heard it from a variety of officials and from the president, too, using language like we'll come after you or obliterate Iran. Clearly, very aggressive language. But that's not the only voice in the U.S. administration. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen a struggle over exactly what the policy should be and how it should be carried out. That may be one of the reasons why President Trump
set in motion and then called off military strikes from military strike from last weekend. It's because there is a tension about exactly how to proceed and some degree of unwillingness to get involved in a and entrenched in a conflict with Iran. There's also a narrative put against that very threatening one from the statement you just mentioned, where there's simultaneously language about open to negotiations and no preconditions for talks. Now, that sounds less serious or less intense next to those threats, but there are both of those narratives coming out of this administration.
Well, and that can be very confusing, can it not, Tarita Parsi? That on the one hand, you've got rhetoric about going to war. On the other hand, and I quoted the president saying, let's make Iran great again. Let's sit down and talk. And then we've got these preconditions on top of that as well.
Confusing is probably an understatement. If it's confusing to the Iranians, you can also see how confusing it is to others. And in fact, just today, the French government, that otherwise probably has been one of the closest countries in Europe when it comes to being close to the American position, came out today and said the United States is actually not being truthful about wanting diplomacy, or that the Trump administration is not being truthful about wanting diplomacy. And I think that's partly because of a pattern of what we've seen, but also because of the new sanctions that were imposed, in which apparently also the Iranian foreign minister is now going to be sanctioned. I mean, it really doesn't send a signal that you're serious about talks if you are sanctioning the person that you're supposed to negotiate with.
Elizabeth, let me get you in on the conversation on that. And the targeting of some of the leadership in Iran, including the foreign minister, including the supreme leader, what message does that send?
Well, it's designed to have a very powerful and personalistic message. It won't have much of a macroeconomic effect at all. It's not going to create more economic friction for Iran, more than it's already subjected to with all of the significant financial and energy sanctions that have already been put in place on Iran. But by going after the senior leadership, it's meant to send a very strong, critical, personalized message. And furthermore, by naming the office of the supreme leader and those that he appoints, and by this, these are institutions, charitable institutions of personal significance to the supreme leader, and that operate not just in Iran, but presumably also those that operate in, for example, Iraq or in Lebanon. So these are designed to go after some of the linkages that Iran has in the region, some of its proxies, its charitable or other work in the region. It's meant to be inflammatory and very aggressive on a personal level.
Well, let me just pick up on that. Are you saying then the supreme leader, the foreign minister, that they have bank accounts in other countries that could be targeted with sanctions?
Presumably, those institutions linked to the supreme leader by virtue of having been individuals appointed by him to or at his request to oversee charitable institutions or other non-governmental or pseudo-governmental organizations that have a regional footprint. This is more linked to the supreme leader, not to the foreign minister here.
Tarita Parsi, let me go back to you. And the U.S. and other countries signed with Iran on the nuclear deal. And as we understand it, Iran essentially has been abiding by the deal, although it looks like they're doing increasing some of their nuclear capabilities in the last month or so. By pulling out of the deal, where does that put the United States?
I'm very happy you asked that question, because I think oftentimes it has kind of gotten lost in the conversation. It's very important to remind ourselves that the only reason why we're in this essentially fabricated crisis is because Trump pulled out of this deal. As you pointed out, the Iranians have been abiding by this deal. They've been abiding by it for more than a year without getting anything, because the U.S. pulled out last year and has actually punished countries for trying to adhere to the deal. It's a very unusual situation, because this is the first time, to the best of my knowledge, in which the United States not only is violating a UN Security Council resolution, it is punishing countries that are trying to abide by a UN Security Council resolution. So we would not be in this situation had it not been for Trump doing this. It's completely unnecessary. And the question is, of course, where do we go from here? Yeah. And I think what you're seeing is that the United States has lost a tremendous amount of credibility when it comes to any idea of a renegotiation because it has not honored the previous deal. Now, Anne from Washington Post pointed out that the administration had various types of concerns about the previous deal. I think the primary one was that it was Obama's signature on it more than anything substantive. Well, if you actually had substantive concerns and you wanted the deal to go further, there was a very clear and easy path for that, relatively easy. And that was to adhere by the existing deal and then negotiate a new agreement on top of the existing deal. Not by ripping apart the existing deal, losing all credibility, creating a crisis, a tension that is almost bringing the United States to war, and then say, well, this is all part of a negotiating strategy. Very few countries buy that.
I'm looking at a headline, Elizabeth, in foreign policy, there is still time for diplomacy with Iran. The risk of war has risen, but a diplomatic solution remains likely. Now, this is dated May 10th, 2019, so a bit more than a month ago. Is there still time for diplomacy with Iran?
There's always time for diplomacy. And in fact, that should go along with any other kind of activity that the United States engages in. So even if we are seeing an escalation of tensions and that moves into the realm of military or cyber or intelligence capabilities, there really needs to be communication, which is to say diplomatic communication, whether it's public and well documented or through back channels. And that is part of a escalation management technique. And unfortunately, by the United States' indication of its desire to name even more senior officials than it already has, that may make it more and more difficult to sustain the kind of communication or diplomacy that would help manage escalation or create a de-escalation if feasible from the both sides.
And that's Elizabeth Rosenberg, Director of the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Trita Parsi with us as well, founder, former president of the National Iranian American Council. We're talking about the standoff, the conflicts between Iran and the United States. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Elizabeth, let me go back to you and talk a bit about sanctions. Sanctions have been imposed on Iran for a number of years now. How much has that hurt the Iranian people?
Well, it's definitely had an overall effect on the Iranian economy. It affects the Iranian people, different constituencies, differently. And there are those close to the supreme leader and state leadership that may be more protected through relationships of patronage or linkage to the kind of companies that have managed through direct backing and support and bailout from the central bank and other government institutions to sustain their activity. So for a cohort of for senior officials and those connected to them through business or other personal relationships, life has not been as bad as it has been for many people who suffer more directly from the difficulty moving money in and out and being able to pay for imports, sometimes of goods that are necessary for health and human safety. There's been a real difficulty moving goods, what are called humanitarian goods often, food, medicine, and medical devices into the country for lack of adequate and free-flowing financial channels to support those imports into Iran.
Going back to you, Trita Parsi, I've always wondered, when have sanctions really ever been effective against Iran or even any country? Because it seems as if it's the people who suffer. If sanctions are designed to weaken a regime or to somehow create the overthrow of a regime, has that ever worked? And would that work in Iran?
The track record of sanctions is extremely weak. We see that very clearly in the academic literature. When it comes to hurting the people, that certainly is usually the case. In fact, the joke at the State Department during the Iraq sanctions was that the last chicken sandwich in Baghdad is going to be eaten by Saddam. Everyone will be sanctioned, but the last person that truly will suffer from it is actually the leadership. And that's going to be exactly the same situation. That's exactly what we also see in Iran right now. The people are suffering tremendously from these sanctions. The economy is going to be contracting roughly 6% this year. The Trump administration itself is saying that they have sanctioned roughly 80% of the Iranian economy. It's impossible to do that without making ordinary people, particularly the most vulnerable people, suffer tremendously. When it comes to whether it would work with Iran, I think it's really important to keep one thing in mind. The Obama administration imposed very harsh sanctions on Iran. But it wasn't actually until the Obama administration, in secret negotiations in Oman, offered the Iranians a very valuable concession, accepting the Iranian red line that they're going to be keeping enrichment on their own soil, but obviously under severe restrictions and transparency measures. Only then did the Iranians show flexibility and start agreeing to their own concessions. So what elicited Iranian flexibility was American flexibility, not American sanctions. It's very critical to understand this because I think there's been a rather misguided narrative in Washington that clearly the Trump administration has bought into, which is that the deal in 2015 came about because the U.S. had such tough sanctions. That's certainly a part of the equation, but it was not the central part of the equation. But the Trump administration has bought the argument that Obama's mistake was that he actually lifted the sanctions too quickly. If he had just gone on for another 6 or so months, the Iranian economy would have collapsed and the regime would have collapsed and a much better deal would have been able to be found. We've not seen any evidence of that whatsoever. In fact, the Iranian leadership's incentive structure is that any type of a capitulation to the United States is complete political suicide for them. They have a stronger incentive to actually stand firm and even risk war than to capitulate to Trump's demands.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Trita Parsi, again, founder, former president of the National Iranian American Council. He's an adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University Center for Security Studies, wrote a book called Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Elizabeth Rosenberg with us as well, director of the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Elizabeth Rosenberg from the Center for a New American Security, also Trita Parsi, founder, former president of the National Iranian American Council, talking about U.S.-Iran relations that have been deteriorating in recent weeks or perhaps even months. Here's President Trump speaking from the Oval Office on Monday after signing an executive order for new sanctions against Iran.
Who knows what's going to happen? I can only tell you we cannot ever let Iran have a nuclear weapon, and it won't happen. And secondly, and very importantly, we don't want money going out to sponsor terror. They are the number one sponsor of terror anywhere in the world. I think a lot of restraint has been shown by us, a lot of restraint, and that doesn't mean we're going to show it in the future. But I felt that we want to Give this a chance. Give it a good chance.
Elizabeth, where do you see things going from here?
That statement that you read captures both threat and also the suggestion that there's restraint in play. So that should strike Iran and everyone else watching as confusing, as we were talking about a little earlier in the program.
Yeah.
And also an indication of tremendous volatility in, coming from U.S. policy and difficulty understanding where a kind of undermining of the credibility from the U.S. line, which is to believed, what is to be believed at this moment versus tomorrow or the next day. So what happens here is that there's great potential for escalation, including in the military domain, because there's not a good way to calibrate what the lines are beyond which the United States is likely to strike out militarily or otherwise at Iran and escalate this conflict. So Iran backed into a corner, I think. The the pride has and of leaders, senior Iranian leaders, has been wounded by a number of U.S. statements. And economically, there's a lot of challenge. It does seem to me that there creates some challenges for Iran's leadership to maintain a strong position vis-a-vis its domestic constituency and has to show that it can respond. So that creates a kind of toxic cocktail where the potential for escalation, intentional as well as unintentional, is pretty high.
Trita, listening to what the president just said, then first of all, how do you think that's interpreted in Iran? And then what options does the Iranian regime have?
I think that one of the main challenges that the Iranians have is that if they even were to contemplate and consider engaging the Trump administration at some point, which I personally think ultimately they should. I think they committed a mistake when they rejected some overtures from Trump early on when he had first become president. But today, if they were trying to do so, they are faced with a very significant obstacle. And the obstacle is that Trump's team is at odds with themselves. Trump probably wants to have some form of a negotiation and likes to make a deal, but that is not the objective of Bolton and Pompeo. At least that's the perception. And the Iranians have been briefed by the North Koreans about their dealings with Trump, and they've actually conveyed that they think Trump wants to deal, can deal, likes to give and take, but that whatever they've agreed to, Pompeo and Bolton have refused to implement and actually have sabotaged. This is a big problem for the Iranians because no Iranian politician can afford yet another negotiation with the United States in which they reach a deal, but then the U.S. does not implement its end of the bargain. So I doubt that the Iranians are going to do anything serious diplomatically with the U.S. as long as John Bolton is in the White House.
Interesting. And I guess the fact that the U.S. pulled out of the Iranian deal and Iran, as you were saying, was abiding by the deal, makes the United States an untrustworthy partner.
Frankly, the Iranians were viewing the U.S. untrustworthy even before the U.S. views Iran untrustworthy, but this certainly did not help.
Here's a comment or question from John, and I'll put this to you, Elizabeth. He says, the U.S. has had tense relations with Iran for decades. Have we learned anything from dealing with their government over the years? Have we?
Well, I think that one lesson that successive U.S. policy leaders have learned is to be cautious and skeptical. There does seem to be a significant inertia to a kind of hostility, a policy level hostility and skepticism about dealing with Iran or making deals with Iran, which is one reason we saw when Obama and his team negotiated the JCPOA with the other parties to it in the last administration. There was quite a lot of discomfort amongst members of Congress and other thought leaders about the notion of entering into an agreement, any agreement, even a limited nuclear agreement with Iran. And the constituencies that favored a broader kind of agreement or demanded capitulation from Iran, which is essentially what Pompeo has demanded and putting forward points for this administration, we see that thread still in U.S. policy. I think that is learned behavior after decades of challenge and difficulty dealing with Iran, that there's still a powerful discomfort that I fear will be generational and difficult to remove for years to come.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Beverly says, what do your guests suggest the U.S. response should be to Iran shooting down a drone valued at over $100 million? An email from B says, this looks like the Gulf of Tonkin redux, the idea that there was the U.S. is being dishonest about what happened. So we're getting two points of view there. Trita Parsi, what should the response of the U.S. be to the downing of a U.S. drone?
This is where I think, again, it's very important to take a step back and see the bigger picture and ask ourselves how we got into this situation in the first place. Because you can take any limited action by the other side and then come up with what would appear to be a very legitimate response to that one single action. But if you take a look at it, the larger picture, mm-hmm. you may be taking a lot of small legitimate actions that nevertheless lead you to a war that is completely illegitimate and unnecessary. We would not be in this situation had the Trump administration not withdrawn from the deal. Now that we are, and we are pursuing economic warfare against Iranians, and these are Trump's own words, then I don't think we should be surprised that there's going to be tensions and incidents of this kind, particularly if it turns out that the drone actually was in Iranian airspace. We don't have a final verdict on that yet. The Russians have come out and said that their data shows that it was in Iranian airspace. The Trump administration says that it was not. We don't know exactly what happened. But this is the problem. We are pursuing a policy that is constantly putting us on the verge of war. And we have to ask ourselves, if we don't want war, we should not be pursuing this policy.
So we should be sitting down and talking?
If we wanted to have a deal that was bigger, we should have sat down, we should have respected the deal, we should have respected America's signature, and then we should have addressed the additional issues. And there are plenty of issues that separate the United States and Iran. There are plenty of things that, from the U.S. perspective, we would want to see a change in policy on the Iranian side. But in the last 40 years, listeners asked, have we learned anything?
Right.
The thing we should have learned is that everything we have tried in the last 40 years that have been coercion and pressure-centered has not worked with Iran. The only time the United States has been able to change in a profound way a central Iranian security policy has been through the JCPOA and the diplomacy that the Obama administration pursued.
Elizabeth,
yet today, we are choosing the path that has been a proven failure.
Elizabeth, an email from Paul who says, confusion is good. Keep Iran guessing. Do you agree?
I certainly agree that that is a tactic that some policy leaders use to great effect to engage in confrontation or to try and keep your adversary off balance. I think that perhaps that could make sense methodologically if there has been a weighing of the risk factors and a willingness to enter into a kind of worst case scenario if that signal is misinterpreted or seen as even more hostile than it was intended. I am not a big fan of that kind of keep them off balance tactical approach in this scenario. I think it's really dangerous. And also, given the fact that most Americans don't support an all-out military confrontation, I was mm-hmm. looking at some polling data from, I believe, The Hill and Politico, which put U.S. Support for a military response at maybe, one in four, maybe up as high as one in three. That's not a huge constituency to have behind you if you are launching are being prepared to launch into serious military confrontation. Can I just respond to that last question
Absolutely.
That you had about
yep.
what should be the U.S. response to Iran shooting down a U.S. military aircraft, regardless of whose airspace that was in? It's been really interesting to me to look at how the different Democratic presidential candidates have responded to this question. It's understandable that people would put exactly that question that your listener put to us, to these candidates, trying to understand what policy alternatives might be in the offing if there's a Democratic presidential candidate. And what I think we've heard, if I can sort of briefly summarize, is a number of them calling for multilateralism, some for diplomacy. We've heard a couple of calls for direct military response mm-hmm. Along the lines of what Trump indicated he was interested in doing and pulled back from. But overwhelmingly, there's a note of caution amongst them, which is to say, be very careful with this situation. And that's certainly in keeping with a broad swath of American concern about the danger of getting entrenched in another Middle Eastern conflict that would cost billions and billions and last for years, to say nothing of how it would distract from other major foreign policy considerations, China and Russia, that many Americans and I think should be really at the forefront of concern and national security policymaking.
Treat another way to put that question is, have we learned anything from the Iraq war?
Well, one of the things I would have hoped we would have learned, and I think the U.S. media has performed a bit better, but there's still some room for improvement, is to be very skeptical about assertions that do not come with clear evidence. Because we are in a scenario in which there are plenty of actors that do have an incentive to start a war. We have allies in the region who have a history of wanting to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran. We have elements in Iran that have in the past shown a recklessness that is very dangerous and that could lead to war. Under those circumstances, we should be very careful and not commit what happened in the run-up to the Iraq war, in which the right questions were not asked at the right time and too much deference was given to government assessments, even when those were not presented with any evidence to back them up.
And again, that's Trita Parsi, who joins us along with Elizabeth Rosenberg. And we are talking about the growing tensions between the United States and Iran, threatened sanctions, applied sanctions as well. And I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Trita Parsi, let me go back to you and help us understand, I guess, the proxies, Iran's proxies in the Middle East and how they function there. I guess we're talking about Hezbollah, we're talking about Hamas and other groups as well. Why does Iran have these proxies and what do they want from the region?
The Iranians from the early 1980s, when the revolution happened, were clearly an anti-status quo power. They challenged the balance of power in the region, they challenged the order in the region, and they were quickly marginalized and excluded because of their own radicalism. And they were left as a result. I mean, they're still not in any security pact with the exception of what they have with Hezbollah and Syria. They were left with no essentially legitimate avenues of influence. So they started to develop these asymmetric capabilities, develop all of these different militias that to a certain extent have been quite successful for them in the sense that they have advanced their influence in the region. But in the long run, it's actually very destabilizing to the region if you have an actor in the region that is so overwhelmingly promoting non-state actors in the region. It undermines the existing states, and when the states are undermined, they become too weak, they collapse, and that is spreading instability. So it is certainly something that is necessary to have a negotiation and seek to push the Iranians away from. The question is, how do you do it? And are there legitimate security concerns that the Iranians have that may also have been driving them towards investing in this strategy that can be alleviated and as a result disincentivizing them from doing these things?
And just to add another complicating factor, obviously the Trump administration, the U.S. has support for Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni, Iran is Shia. And there we get to this Sunni-Shia split in the Middle East, Trita.
Yes, although I would, I think that has been overstated, not in the sense that it doesn't exist, it certainly does, but I don't think it's the driving force of this conflict. The driving force is a geopolitical competition that has been going on for quite some time, and it has been intensified partly because the order that existed in the region before was destroyed when the United States invaded Iraq and we had the collapse of Iraq. So it is important, but I think another thing to keep in mind here to just understand the context is Saudi Arabia roughly spends 5 to 6 times more on weapons than the Iranians do. Mm. The UAE, which is a very small country, spends more money on arms than the Iranians do. And almost all of those weapons are coming from the United States. The United States is pouring so much weaponry into the southern part of the Persian Gulf. And that in and of itself is fueling Iranian threat perceptions. I think if we actually want to see a stable Middle East, one component of that has to be that we have to stop arming people to the teeth.
Well, we could go on. We have to end our conversation. Trita Parsi, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Elizabeth Rosenberg, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Rosenberg, Senior Fellow, Director of the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Trita Parsi, Founder, former President of the National Iranian American Council, an Adjunct Associate Professor at Georgetown University Center for Security Studies, wrote a book called Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Democracy. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.